Chapter 33. There is some approach to agreement upon another point, that there will be no revolution. Men say, look at our history, revolutions have not been in our line, and look at our political map, its construction is unfavorable to an organized uprising, and without unity what could a revolt accomplish? It is this union which has held our empire together for centuries, and what it has done in the past it may continue to do now, and in the future. The most intelligible sketch I have encountered of this unintelligible arrangement of things was contributed to the Traveler's Record by Mr. Forrest Morgan, of Hartford, 3 years ago. He says, the Austro-Hungarian monarchy is the patchwork quilt, the midway plaisance, the national chain gang of Europe, a state that is not a nation, but a collection of nations, some with national memories and aspirations and others without, some occupying distinct provinces almost purely their own, and others mixed with alien races, but each with a different language, and each mostly holding the others foreigners as much as if the link of a common government did not exist. Only one of its races even now comprises, so much as 1/4 of the whole, and not another, so much as 1/6, and each has remained for ages as unchanged in isolation, however mingled together in locality, as globules of oil and water. There is nothing else in the modern world that is nearly like it, though there have been plenty in past ages. It seems unreal and impossible, even though we know it is true. It violates all our feeling as to what a country should be in order to have a right to exist, and it seems as though it was too ramshackle to go on holding together any length of time. Yet it has survived, much in its present shape, 2 centuries of storms that have swept perfectly unified countries from existence and others that have brought it to the verge of ruin, has survived formidable European coalitions to dismember it, and has steadily gained force after each, forever changing in its exact makeup, losing in the West, but gaining in the East. The changes leave the structure as firm as ever, like the dropping off and adding on of logs in a raft, its mechanical union of pieces showing all the vitality of genuine national life. That seems to confirm and justify the prevalent Austrian faith, that in this confusion of unrelated and irreconcilable elements, this condition of incurable disunion, there is strength for the government. Nearly every day someone explains to me that a revolution would not succeed here. It couldn't, you know. Broadly speaking, all the nations in the empire hate the government, but they all hate each other too, and with devoted and enthusiastic bitterness. No two of them can combine. The nation that rises must rise alone. Then the others would joyfully join the government against her, and she would have just a fly's chance against a combination of spiders. This government is entirely independent. It can go its own road, and do as it pleases. It has nothing to fear. In countries like England and America, where there is one tongue and the public interests are common, the government must take account of public opinion. But in Austria-Hungary there are 19 public opinions, one for each state. No, 2 or 3 for each state, since there are 2 or 3 nationalities in each. A government cannot satisfy all these public opinions. It can only go through the motions of trying. This government does that. It goes through the motions, and they do not succeed. But that does not worry the government much. The next man will give you some further information. The government has a policy, a wise one, and sticks to it. This policy is tranquility. Keep this hive of excitable nations as quiet as possible. Encourage them to amuse themselves with things less inflammatory than politics. To this end it furnishes them an abundance of Catholic priests, to teach them to be docile and obedient, and to be diligent in acquiring ignorance about things here below, and knowledge about the kingdom of heaven, to whose historic delights they are going to add the charm of their society by and by. And further, to this same end, it cools off the newspapers every morning at 5 o'clock, whenever warm events are happening. There is a censor of the press, and apparently he is always on duty and hard at work. A copy of each morning paper is brought to him at 5 o'clock. His official wagons wait at the doors of the newspaper offices and scud to him with the first copies that come from the press. His company of assistants read every line in these papers, and mark everything which seems to have a dangerous look. Then he passes final judgment upon these markings. Two things conspire to give to the results a capricious and unbalanced look. His assistants have diversified notions as to what is dangerous and what isn't. He can't get time to examine their criticisms in much detail, and so sometimes the very same matter which is suppressed in one paper fails to be damned in another one, and gets published in full feather and unmodified. Then the paper in which it was suppressed blandly copies the forbidden matter into its evening edition, provokingly giving credit and detailing all the circumstances in courteous and inoffensive language, and of course the censor cannot say a word. Sometimes the censor sucks all the blood out of a newspaper, and leaves it colorless and inane. Sometimes he leaves it undisturbed, and lets it talk out its opinions with a frankness and vigor hardly to be surpassed, I think, in the journals of any country. Apparently the censor sometimes revises his verdicts upon second thought, for several times lately he has suppressed journals after their issue and partial distribution. The distributed copies are then sent for by the censor and destroyed. I have two of these, but at the time they were sent for I could not remember what I had done with them. If the censor did his work before the morning edition was printed, he would be less of an inconvenience than he is. But, of course, the papers cannot wait many minutes after 5 o'clock to get his verdict. They might as well go out of business as do that. So they print, and take their chances. Then, if they get caught by a suppression, they must strike out the condemned matter, and print the edition over again. That delays the issue several hours, and is expensive besides. The government gets the suppressed edition for nothing. If it bought it, that would be joyful, and would give great satisfaction. Also, the edition would be larger. Some of the papers do not replace the condemned paragraphs with other matter. They merely snatch they out and leave blanks behind, morning blanks, marked confiscated. The government discourages the dissemination of newspaper information in other ways. For instance, it does not allow newspapers to be sold on the streets. Therefore, the newsboy is unknown in Vienna. And there is a stamp duty of nearly a cent upon each copy of a newspaper's issue. Every American paper that reaches me has a stamp upon it, which has been pasted there in the post office, or downstairs in the hotel office. But no matter who put it there, I have to pay for it, and that is the main thing. Sometimes friends send me so many papers that it takes all I can earn that week to keep this government going. I must take passing notice of another point in the government's measures for maintaining tranquility. Everybody says it does not like to see any individual attain to commanding influence in the country, since such a man can become a disturber and an inconvenience. We have as much talent as the other nations, says the citizen, resignedly, and without bitterness. But for the sake of the general good of the country, we are discouraged from making it over conspicuous. And not only discouraged, but tactfully and skillfully prevented from doing it, if we show too much persistence. Consequently, we have no renowned men. In centuries we have seldom produced one, that is, seldom allowed one to produce himself. We can say today, what no other nation of first importance in the family of Christian civilizations can say, that there exists no Austrian who has made an enduring name for himself which is familiar all around the globe. Another helper toward tranquility is the army. It is as pervasive as the atmosphere. It is everywhere. All the mentioned creators, promoters, and preservers of the public tranquility do their several shares in the quieting work. They make a restful and comfortable serenity and reposefulness. This is disturbed sometimes for a little while. A mob assembles to protest against something. It gets noisy, noisier, still noisier, finally too noisy. Then the persuasive soldiery comes charging down upon it, and in a few minutes all is quiet again, and there is no mob. There is a constitution and there is a parliament. The House draws its membership of 425 deputies from the 19 or 20 states heretofore mentioned. These men represent peoples who speak 11 different languages. That means 11 distinct varieties of jealousies, hostilities, and warring interests. This could be expected to furnish forth a parliament of a pretty inharmonious sort, and make legislation difficult at times, and it does that. The parliament is split up into many parties, the clericals, the progressists, the German nationalists, the young Czechs, the social democrats, the Christian socialists, and some others, and it is difficult to get up working combinations among them. They prefer to fight apart sometimes. The recent troubles have grown out of Count Badeni's necessities. He could not carry on his government without a majority vote in the House at his back, and in order to secure it, he had to make a trade of some sort. He made it with the Czechs, the Bohemians. The terms were not easy for him. He must issue an ordinance making the Czech tongue the official language in Bohemia in place of the German. This created a storm. All the Germans in Austria were incensed. In numbers they form but a fourth part of the empire's population, but they urge that the country's public business should be conducted in one common tongue, and that tongue a world language which German is. However, Badeni secured his majority. The German element in parliament was apparently become helpless. The Czech deputies were exultant. Then the music began. Badeni's voyage, instead of being smooth, was disappointingly rough from the start. The government must get the Ausgleich through. It must not fail. Badeni's majority was ready to carry it through, but the minority was determined to obstruct it and delay it until the obnoxious Czech language measure should be shelved. The Ausgleich is an adjustment, arrangement, settlement, which holds Austria and Hungary together. It dates from 1867, and has to be renewed every 10 years. It establishes the share which Hungary must pay toward the expenses of the imperial government. Hungary is a kingdom, the Emperor of Austria is its king, and has its own parliament and governmental machinery. But it has no foreign office, and it has no army, at least its army is a part of the imperial army, is paid out of the imperial treasury, and is under the control of the imperial war office. The 10-year arrangement was due a year ago, but failed to connect, at least completely. A year's compromise was arranged. A new arrangement must be effected before the last day of this year. Otherwise the two countries become separate entities. The emperor would still be king of Hungary, that is, king of an independent foreign country. There would be Hungarian custom houses on the Austrian border, and there would be a Hungarian army and a Hungarian foreign office. Both countries would be weakened by this, both would suffer damage. The opposition in the house, although in the minority, had a good weapon to fight with in the pending Ausgleich. If it could delay the Ausgleich a few weeks, the government would doubtless have to withdraw the hated language ordinance or lose Hungary. The opposition began its fight. Its arms were the rules of the house. It was soon manifest that by applying these rules ingeniously it could make the majority helpless, and keep it so, as long as it pleased. It could shut off business every now and then with a motion to adjourn. It could require the yeas and noes on the motion, and use up 30 minutes on that detail. It could call for the reading and verification of the minutes of the preceding meeting, and use up half a day in that way. It could require that several of its members be entered upon the list of permitted speakers previously to the opening of a sitting, and as there is no time limit, further delays could thus be accomplished. These were all lawful weapons, and the men of the opposition, technically called the left, were within their rights in using them. They used them to such dire purpose that all parliamentary business was paralyzed. The right, the government side, could accomplish nothing. Then it had a saving idea. This idea was a curious one. It was to have the president and the vice presidents of the parliament trample the rules underfoot upon occasion. This, for a profoundly embittered minority constructed out of fire and gun cotton. It was time for idle strangers to go and ask leave to look down out of a gallery and see what would be the result of it. 2. A memorable sitting. And now took place that memorable sitting of the House which broke two records. It lasted the best part of 2 days and a night, surpassing by half an hour the longest sitting known to the world's previous parliamentary history, and breaking the long speech record with Dr. Letcher's 12-hour effort, the longest flow of unbroken talk that ever came out of one mouth since the world began. At 8:45 on the evening of the 28th of October, when the House had been sitting a few minutes short of 10 hours, Dr. Letcher was granted the floor. It was a good place for theatrical effects. I think that no other Senate House is so shapely as this one, or so richly and showily decorated. Its plan is that of an opera house. Up toward the straight side of it, the stage side, rise a couple of terraces of desks for the ministry, and the official clerks or secretaries, terraces 30 feet long, and each supporting about half a dozen desks with spaces between them. Above these is the president's terrace, against the wall. Along it are distributed the proper accommodations for the presiding officer and his assistants. The wall is of richly colored marble, highly polished, its paneled sweep relieved by fluted columns, and pilasters of distinguished grace and dignity, which glow softly and frostily in the electric light. Around the spacious half-circle of the floor, bends the great two-storied curve of the boxes, its frontage elaborately ornamented and sumptuously gilded. On the floor of the House the 425 desks radiate fanwise from the President's Tribune. The galleries are crowded on this particular evening, for word has gone about that the Ausgleich is before the House, that the President, Ritter von Abrahamowicz, has been throttling the rules, that the opposition are in an inflammable state in consequence, and that the night session is likely to be of an exciting sort. The gallery guests are fashionably dressed, and the finery of the women makes a bright and pretty show under the strong electric light. But down on the floor there is no costumery. The deputies are dressed in day clothes, some of the clothes neat and trim, others not. There may be 3 members in evening dress, but not more. There are several Catholic priests in their long black gowns, and with crucifixes hanging from their necks. No member wears his hat. One may see by these details that the aspects are not those of an evening sitting of an English House of Commons, but rather those of a sitting of our House of Representatives. In his high place sits the President, Abrahamowicz, object of the opposition's limitless hatred. He is sunk back in the depths of his armchair, and has his chin down. He brings the ends of his spread fingers together, in front of his breast, and reflectively taps them together, with the air of one who would like to begin business, but must wait, and be as patient as he can. It makes you think of Richelieu. Now and then he swings his head up to the left, or to the right and answers something which someone has bent down to say to him. Then he taps his fingers again. He looks tired, and may be a trifle harassed. He is a gray-haired, long, slender man, with a colorless long face, which, in repose, suggests a death mask, but when not in repose is tossed and rippled by a turbulent smile which washes this way and that, and is not easy to keep up with a pious smile, a holy smile, a saintly smile, a deprecating smile, a beseeching and supplicating smile, and when it is at work the large mouth opens, and the flexible lips crumple, and unfold, and crumple again, and move around in a genial and persuasive and angelic way, and expose large glimpses of the teeth, and that interrupts the sacredness of the smile, and gives it momentarily a mixed worldly and political and satanic cast. It is a most interesting face to watch. And then the long hands and the body, they furnish great and frequent help to the face in the business of adding to the force of the statesman's words. To change the tense. At the time of which I have just been speaking, the crowds in the galleries were gazing at the stage and the pit with rapt interest and expectancy. One half of the great fan of desks was in effect empty, vacant. In the other half, several hundred members were bunched and jammed together as solidly as the bristles in a brush, and they also were waiting and expecting. Presently the chair delivered this utterance. Apostrophe Dr. Letcher as the floor. Apostrophe apostrophe, then burst out such another wild and frantic and deafening clamor as has not been heard on this planet since the last time the Comanches surprised. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.